this is Craig Valentine, host of Early to Rise Radio. Have you ever wanted to become wealthier, healthier, wiser, or just have more time to appreciate the finer things in life? On this show, we reveal what high performers are doing every day to be more successful without sacrificing their personal lives. Early to Rise Radio is sponsored by the Perfect Day Formula. Get your free copy of this game-changing success guide at freeperfectdaybook.com. Now let's get started with today's show. Hey, have you ever thought about what it would be like if you could go back in time and get to know your parents when they were young? You see, it always fascinates me because I grew up the son of an alcoholic, hell-raising father and a conservative Christian mother. They were just so different that to this day, I still can't figure out what brought the two of them together. Regardless, here I am, and on today's show, we're going to do a deep dive into the making of Craig Valentine and how I grew up as a persistent young farm boy and turned those lessons of personal responsibility and hard work that my parents taught me into a million-dollar fitness business and eventually led me on the journey that helped me get to owning the business of my dreams. Along the way, I'm going to reveal a lot of embarrassing moments from my life. You're going to hear about my unlikely childhood idol. And you're also going to get to meet the one person in this world that can make me raging mad. Yes. And we'll cover how my 12 rules of living have changed since I wrote that article when I bought Early to Rise. This is going to be a really fun show. And ETR's editor, Jeff Steen, interrogates me like he's a CIA agent. I mean, he just does not let me away with anything on this one. So you're going to love today's episode of Early to Rise Radio. I'm your host, Craig Valentine, and we want to invite you to sit back and join me and Jeff Steen during our in-person interview that we held in the Early to Rise office in downtown Denver. Now, before we get started, don't forget to pick up a copy of my book with even more tales about how I became the world's most productive man. Grab your free copy at freeperfectdaybook.com. Now let's jump into the interview. It's a no-holds-barred one from the get-go, and Jeff goes for the jugular with his very first question.
So you have talked a lot about your time, your childhood in Toronto, growing up on a farm, and I don't want you to rehash the same old stories, but I do have a couple of questions, follow-ups. So you've mentioned on a number of occasions that your dad was an alcoholic.
Yes.
Right. That's something you struggled with as a kid. You also had a lot of praise for him. You said he was a fearless man, but I'm wondering.
Crazy
fearless?
Crazy fearless.
Well,
absolutely.
You told that story where he was hanging off of the silo.
Right. So we had first of all, just to be specific, it was not in Toronto. Toronto's a big city. So the farm wasn't in Toronto. It was about an hour and a half away from Toronto. Although I will say that up until 2 or 3 years ago, Toronto had a slaughterhouse in downtown Toronto, like downtown in the financial district. So imagine if you were in Wall Street and all you could smell was pigs. That's what Toronto had up until a few years ago. And the funny thing was, Toronto's nickname was actually Hogtown because, for one reason, of that slaughterhouse. But then all these condos came in, and for everybody around there, they were very happy that it left. But
forced out, yeah.
But I mean, it was like being back on the farm. So anyways, my father was pretty crazy fearless. I always like to say, and I remember this from a summer vacation that we took, whenever he saw a keep out sign, it meant go in. And so like now I am like the most conservative type person that terrifies me when I see a keep out sign, because I would just remember him. Not only would he go in, he would make me go with him. And I always thought we were going to get in trouble. And sometimes we did. And I didn't know what was going
to
happen.
But I was going to say, was there a traumatic experience where you linked that to something that you got in trouble or something bad happened so that you were no longer that fearless person that your father was?
Yeah. So every day after, in the wintertime after school, I would come home and we would go out on snowmobiles. So my dad had a couple of snowmobiles, and sometimes I would drive one and he would drive one, and then sometimes I would just sit on the back, but he drove so fast. Like, I'm really glad that he never had a motorcycle, but he would drive the snowmobile really fast. And one day he saw a fox and he thought he would chase the fox with the snowmobile. We ended up flipping the snowmobile. So, I mean, that's like, I might've been 10 years old. And so it was just repeated stuff like that. Like, I don't want to make light of this at all, but my father probably drove drunk about 100 to 500 times in his life. And he got arrested 3 times, but he would drive me in the front seat of, well, in the pickup truck, no seatbelt, drive really fast. I mean, so it was just all these terrifying moments. It was like being on a roller coaster ride all the time, and emotionally, and even just in terms of the things that we did. So I think that's that. I just wanted to be the opposite of that, I guess you would say.
It's interesting that you bring up the issue of him driving drunk, because I was going to dig into a little bit more of what it was like to live with your father, who was an alcoholic. Now you spend a lot of time helping clients and people who are struggling with alcohol get over that. What do you think enables you to do that now? What tools did you gain from living with that as a kid that makes it more easier for you to deal with that now as a coach?
I would say that you have to understand that you can't force help on someone like that. And the only way that I can help people is when they say, hey, can you help me? So, I mean, you know, my mother and father argued for a long, long time, and then she just quit. She just gave up on him. And I'm sure there were lots of other people that tried to get him to change. His brother was also an alcoholic and a drug user. So I don't know if there's some genetic stuff or whatever, but you know, you can't just say to an alcoholic, hey, you should change, and they're going to listen to you. They have to at some point come to the realization that they need to change. And those are the people that come and work with me. If I was working with somebody who didn't want to stop drinking or didn't want to change something in their family life, I'd have no hope. I'd have no hope, because you just, especially at that level, when it's an addiction, you can't force change on somebody. So it's understanding that, and then recognizing, I know that in science, there are different stages of change of individuals, and you have to recognize where you can help somebody and where you can't. Yeah. But I don't think my father ever even tried.
Hmm. Well, you know, you mentioned your mom. It's interesting. You mentioned your mom trying and then at some point giving up. I've heard a lot of stories about your dad and the influences he's had on you, but I don't hear a lot about your mom. I don't hear a lot about the influence, the impact she had on you, and what she taught you in that process as she was trying to get him to quit. And then as you know, you were growing older and being, you know, raised by her, both of them. So tell me a little bit about the big impacts she's had on you.
Well, I would say that if it wasn't for my mother, I'd probably be in jail, because, you know, whenever I think of the two of them, you remember like in the cartoons where you have like the devil on the shoulder and angel?
Yeah.
Like that's them to a T, because I have no idea how they would even have gotten together, because my mother goes to church every Sunday. My father never went to church. I mean, the guy invented swear words. He was the complete opposite of my mother, who is just very conservative, so giving and all these things. And so it's hard for me to reconcile that in my head a little bit.
Yeah.
But had they split up and I had been for some reason stuck with my father, I think I'd be in a world of trouble right now. Mm-hmm. So she kept me on the straight and narrow. And she also, really just, you know, showed me long-term thinking. Like she would have me, even when I got my first job, I would, you know, save some money and put it in like a low interest savings account. So she was teaching me that stuff at like age 10, age 12, because she didn't finish high school. And I think she had a lot of regrets about that. And so she really pushed my sister. Well, she didn't push, but she was like, hey, you're going to do your homework and make sure that you do really well in school so you can go to college. And I think there was only one or two times where we ever had a conversation where she mentioned regretting that sort of thing. But she worked just as hard as my father did. So I always mentioned that I learned a lot about hard work from my father.
Yeah.
But my mother worked just as hard. I mean, she worked from 8 till 4 as a secretary in a factory, at a big factory in town. And then she would come home, and in the wintertime she would sew clothes. And in the summertime, she would be out in the garden until about 8 o'clock at night, and then she'd be canning food. So she was a very thrifty farm woman. So I learned a lot about hard work and ingenuity from her that way. But she was also very conservative and very safe and, you know, didn't really like the idea of me becoming an entrepreneur, didn't really understand what I was going to school for, for exercise physiology. I remember one day she said, oh yeah, some guy just got a job on the factory floor and he has the same degree as you're going through. And I think that really terrified her for a bit. She just wanted me to become an accountant, get a real job sort of thing, because she didn't really understand the vision that I had. So there was definitely a lot of hard work, but being conservative and not thinking that you could really get to super high levels. But, you know, she definitely kept me out of trouble for sure. And the thing, maybe the reason I don't talk about her is because I'm such a mama's boy. I'm almost kind of like embarrassed to admit, you know, when I visit her, she makes all the food, she does all my laundry. Yeah. I'm still like in high school phase, you know, so maybe don't want to mention a little bit too much about that, lest people think I'm not this globetrotting, awesome James Bondish type of guy.
Well, it's out there in the world now.
Yes.
So no pulling it back. So you mentioned that she wanted you to move ahead in life, but in a conservative fashion. Yeah. And you clearly, your whole life seemed to have had this vision of doing more. So did that grate against you? Did it feel like she was expecting less of you than you were capable of? Is that something that you struggled with and that motivated you more to push the envelope and then to become the successful entrepreneur that you are now?
No, it's a good question. Both of my parents never were the type of people to push you into anything, nor were they the type of people to stop you from doing anything. Okay. So there wasn't, I'm very fortunate in that, like, it only came up once or twice. Maybe she had these worries all the time, but we didn't talk about it at all. I'm 99% sure my father had no idea what I ever did, because he never used email. He never had a cell phone. He passed away in 2008. So even up until that point, he didn't have any of those things.
Yeah.
And he would just look at me sitting in front of a computer and probably put his hands up and go, I don't know what you're doing over there. But he realized I was doing okay, I guess. But no, they never really had impact one way or another in terms – even with homework and stuff, like, I just happen to do my own homework. Actually, one thing I want to mention about my mom is that she taught – she every night in, like, grade school when I was, like, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, she would do homework with us every night. So she was really helpful, and I would be competitive with my sister. So I was always – you know, and she's 2 years older than me, so I was always trying to work up to that level. Yeah. And they were just supportive but at the same time, they were almost just like so busy working that they were hands off and they didn't really worry too much. They kind of knew what we were doing and they were just letting us go and do our own thing. And so the impact and influence on their expectations for me never really weighed in. I was just going and doing my thing and I knew I was going to be okay. And I think my sister, who's like a force of nature on her own, is the same way, that she just knew she was going to go and do her own thing. Now, I will say this, like, the way that my parents raised me, they would both be in jail, because they would leave me at home. Like, I was home by myself at age 4, like, by myself, because my father was working in the fields and my mom was at work. So I basically raised myself in the morning and in the afternoon. My dad would come in and check on me at lunchtime. And then I would pee in certain areas of the house that weren't appropriate, but because I was lazy, I guess. But other than that, I was okay. And then another thing that they probably would get arrested for today is that at nighttime, in the summertime, I played baseball. And to play baseball, like, the baseball field was like 2 miles away from my house, but on all these country roads. And if I wanted to play baseball, I had to bike there by myself. And so in the summertime, I'd be biking home from the baseball diamond at like 8 o'clock, literally on over 2 miles on backcountry roads that were relatively dangerous because people drive fast on them, but they were dirt roads. Yeah. And, like, you know, that's the type of thing where it's like, yeah, it's child abducted, you know, and he's and like, people would always, like, when I got to baseball, they go, you biked here? You're like 8 years old and you bike 2 miles to baseball on like some rickety old bike. So, you know, they kind of threw me into the old personal responsibility. So maybe they had a big impact on me on that way
too. Yeah. Just inadvertently, that sort of was the foundation for what you're doing.
Cause they were too busy working.
Yeah. Yeah. But 4 years old, my God.
I have this one moment in my life that I will always remember. And I'm in the barn and I'm playing around with a pitchfork and some hay, and I'm throwing some hay down this hole. And I was backing up and I was walking backwards, and I almost like had this like voice from God say, turn around like right now. Cause if I would have taken one more step, I would have fallen 12 feet onto concrete through this hole. So, but I mean, that's the kind of thing that happened to me all the time. And then we lived in the country with all this space, and they would just say, okay, go outside and play. And I'd show up again 3 hours later. Yeah. They weren't looking for me. They were just like kind of hoping I would come back. Maybe they weren't. Maybe they were like Hansel and Gretel and just like pushing me out there. I don't know. Like maybe one day they were just going to run away from me. But yeah, I mean, I totally raised myself in a lot of ways. And I think that's why I'm pretty comfortable just kind of being on my own, doing my own thing a lot too.
Yeah. Well, what about your sister? Were you sort of like very close growing up? Mm-mm. So no, not at all.
No, we basically fought a lot. And she's a very strong personality. Yeah. We're probably closer than ever, but as adults, we were not, like from 20s and 30s, not very close. And she can make me angrier than anybody else in the world. She knows exactly what to say. And I remember in high school, I was almost going to rip the phone off the wall. She was making me so angry. So she knows how to win those battles.
Is it just pushing buttons, or is it like ideological differences that separate you?
She's pretty hard driven. She's like an alpha woman, but she would just know what to say, and she does not hesitate to say it.
Yeah. Well,
yeah,
you know,
she's been to one of our Toys for Tots things, but not in the last couple of years. So
yeah,
you guys haven't met her, but I'm pretty sure Bianca has. Yeah. And I know Jeff and Matt have as well.
Well, maybe next year I'll have a chance to meet her. That'd be cool. I want to transition a little bit from when you were a kid. There's a lot of good stuff there. I'm wondering though, before we leave that time in your life, who your heroes and idols were growing up? Like, who did you look up to?
Gary Carter. Gary Carter, who was in Montreal Expo and New York Met. So I like, you know, this guy, he had this crazy red afro. And so I don't know, for some reason, I really liked him as a baseball player. And then, I don't know, I don't think I really had heroes that I can think of. You know, I didn't really read comics. I read a lot of books, but I was just kind of in my own little world, I guess. One thing that I'll say that kind of describes me is that in first grade, or as we say in Canada, grade one, which is – that's what we said. But here in America, it's first grade. So in first grade, there were these two kids who were – they got to go to the principal's office and read to the principal because they could read big words and stuff. And I got upset. I was like, well, I want to do that too. So I taught myself how to read so that I could go to the principal's office and join the other people. So I guess that just shows you like – again, it's like if I want to do something, if it is to be, it's up to me. I really believe that. And so – it's personal responsibility. People, I was on a podcast recently and it came up, like, we were talking about spirituality or something. I just said, if I had a religion, it'd be the religion of personal responsibility. And I think my childhood in many forms did that, but also I think I was kind of born that way too.
It's interesting you bring that up because it seems to me that goes hand in hand, or can go hand in hand, with competition. Were you very competitive growing up, and did that kind of lead into the fitness realm for you? Was that a logical progression?
I was very competitive. I'm a very poor loser. And so I actually had, once I became an adult, I realized it's probably best I remove myself from sports because I think it made me angrier than the enjoyment I got out of it. So that drove me to perform really well. But I don't think that's not the reason I got into fitness, really. I got into fitness to get stronger, build muscle, and then from there it just became a really easy way to build a business for me, I think.
Okay. Yeah. So that was natural. So Turbulence Training launched in, was it 2000?
Around 2001, I think I first mentioned it, and I think I probably sold the first Turbulence Training program maybe a year or two later.
And that has been, as everyone listening likely already knows, it was very successful for you. Mm-hmm. Why? What was it about that brand and that time and the products that you created that made it so successful?
I think a lot of it was timing. Very lucky that I was one of the first people to build an online fitness business. So you could actually argue that it's a stupid name because, you know, most people, like, what does that even mean? Although P90X is kind of the same way too, but it's really the advertising and the marketing that goes behind it. But they're not well-named programs. They're kind of catchy, but if you have to explain it, and once people understand it, then the catchiness of it becomes a benefit. But at first, when you're explaining to somebody who has no idea, it's actually a really poorly named product. So I got into Men's Health Magazine in 2000. So I had credibility, which allowed me to, you know, take Turbulence Training to a larger audience. It allowed me to get that name in the magazine once in a while. So that was beneficial. But a lot of it, quite frankly, is completely lucky timing that, you know, when I got online in 2001, started selling stuff in 2003, got some momentum, and then 2006 really had big success and exponential results because I hired a coach. I mean, there was a fraction, maybe 1% of the competition that is out there now.
Right.
So I'm not that smart when it comes to marketing, and I was really just lucky that I recognized a trend, and I got in on a trend that was growing so rapidly, so that's why. And then I was persistent with it as well.
Right. Did you, now when you say it's sort of just a logical progression based on the studies that you had done in college and that kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
and there was a good time for it, did you ever consider getting a job at another company, or were you always zeroed in on entrepreneurship?
I worked for a little bit for another company in the nutrition supplement space.
And
I liked that. And then I was a personal trainer for somebody else for a long time. So for about 2002 to 2005, I did personal training anywhere from 30 hours. 30 hours was probably maybe 35 hours a week was probably the most. And then just cut it down year after year after year until I was able to quit pretty much all of it in 2005, 2006.
Gotcha. Okay. So you realized that the Turbulence Training was going to become something that you wanted to spend time on, and it was going to...
Yeah. I mean, when it was out in 2002, I was working like, how can I make this full time?
Right.
How can I make this full time? And I'm not really a very employable person.
Why is that?
Well, I think most entrepreneurs are not really employable. I mean, I do not like to be told what to do. I want to operate on my own schedule. I want to build my own systems. I want generally to have most of the say in a lot of things. So that generally describes a lot of entrepreneurs, and most entrepreneurs are not generally employable.
So given what you know now in 2018, with the success of Turbulence Training, sort of two questions that probably go hand in hand. One is, if you were to do that today, how would you do it differently? And then, you know, what lessons did you learn on that journey that you're now using in ETR?
Okay, so the first thing, you know, if I was starting from scratch today, okay, then I would definitely have to be in amazing physical shape in terms of either performance or physique, because you really have to, in general, stand out with that on Instagram, and then also use that in your video. So I think it's very difficult if you do not have a dramatic demonstration of your body, or a demonstration of maybe you're really awesome, you're fast, or your interval capacity is amazing. You really need to be able to do something on video, or even just look good in photos, that allows you to catch people's eyes. Because back when I started, it was very much the written word was the dominant way of marketing. In fact, you know, you weren't getting YouTube until about 2006. And even then, you know, video was slow to upload and very difficult. Now it's so easy to do that. Those are the two most obvious ways to stand out. Otherwise, I would go even deeper into writing and stand out that way, because there still is an opportunity for people to go heavy, heavy writing and stand out with scientific explanations and, you know, taking complex scientific stuff and breaking it down into simple articles. So you'd really have to bet on one end of the extreme, either be the best writer out there in the fitness world, or be somebody who has a dramatic demonstration that stands out among all the other dramatic demonstrations in this world.
Yeah, the visual element too, as it becomes more dynamic. So what about the lessons that you learned in the building of that, and then how those are being employed today?
I think one of the biggest lessons that I learned was the ability to become a better communicator through video and audio. So in 2007, I just made a video of this on one of my Instagram stories the other day. about how bad of a communicator I was in terms of video presentation back in 2007 when I put my first videos on YouTube. But that video has been watched almost 2 million times. Now, I actually have a video that was put out about 3 years ago, which has been watched 2.6 million times. And the difference in the communication style is almost night and day. Like there's energy, there's a bit of humor to the one that has been watched 2.6 million times. And that growth in me came through the turbulence training stuff. And so now I'm able to communicate on stage. I'm able to communicate through these podcasts so much better. And it's practice, repetition. I've done over 175 interviews. I've done hundreds of videos. I've spoken on stage so many more times and presented in my workshops hundreds of times that just the repetition and then also going back and taking a look and the feedback and improving, getting expert advice, that the communication verbally and audio-wise, or verbally and visually, have been the two biggest growth aspects that have served me now in Early to Rise.
For those people who have video and audio as a sort of central component to their marketing or their products, and they're just starting up, do you recommend that, aside from practicing, that they actually get an expert coach, that that's something that they should do at the outset?
That's a good question. I would say that it would not hurt. But as long as you need to be purposeful about what are you getting the coaching on? So are you getting coaching on just being a better presenter? Are you getting coach? Because there's a presenter coach and then there's a sales coach. So, you know, a presenter coach is going to teach you how to get the standing ovations, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be learning how to sell your products from stage or your products through Facebook ads or your products through video. So you need to figure out which type of coach do I need to get and then get one of them based on that. Because they are they're not two completely opposite things, but they're two different things for sure.
No, it's a good thing to note. Absolutely. I want to pivot a little bit because, you know, you've had the success with TT, but you're in a different realm now. You've talked ad nauseum about your struggles with anxiety, right? And there was some alcohol use that figured into that as well. Simon Sinek famously talks about knowing your why, and knowing your why personally and professionally can help drive your business. It can help you make decisions, that kind of thing. So I'm wondering, in that period of anxiety, and when was that?
2006.
Was that primarily, can you say now that in retrospect that that was primarily because you didn't really know your why?
Oh, I don't think it had nothing to do with that, to be honest with you. I think it had everything to do with the fact that I had introverted tendencies, that I did not communicate very well or very often with people, that I was angry and like my father was an angry, bitter, jealous man, and I had that aspect of it. I think it was almost all related to my personality issues and being a type A person and being laced up. I don't think it had anything to do with business and clear path about my future.
Okay. So then talk about a little bit how you made the transition and the revelation you had that you wanted ETR, you wanted to sort of change the business path for yourself. What did that look like?
Well, I wanted to be out of the fitness industry before I even started being in the fitness industry. It was just an easy step. It was the clearest path. But as soon as I started reading Early to Rise in 2001, I realized I want to do more than just tell people how to lose weight or work out. I wanted to help people build their wealth. I wanted to help people find how to invest in real estate. I wanted to help people do all of these things. That was so much more interesting to me because I think you deal with a much more interesting end user than someone who just wants to go and do a couple minutes of exercise or, you know, whose main focus is to lose weight.
Right.
And so once I became a reader of Early to Rise and knew that that thing was out there, then I was, okay, how do I figure out how to build my own version of this or do something? And, you know, we started coaching people with online business courses back in 2007. I started coaching other people in the fitness world how to build an online fitness business. So I've been doing that aspect of things for a long time. I just didn't really know how to get the whole ETR model going.
Gotcha. At the Perfect Life Retreat, and I know you said this more than one time, but last November at the Perfect Life Retreat, you unabashedly said to the audience of 200 some that you have a gift for this. You have a gift for coaching. Can you define that?
Yeah, it's the gift of being able to see what is right for other people. And it sounds pretty egotistical, but I describe myself as the chess master, the person who can move, you know, Bobby from where he is right now to the winning position on the board. And I've always been able to do that. So that's why I would say it's a gift. And then the experience that I've built over the last 17 years or 18 years of helping people transform, whether it's physically or financially, has just strengthened that. It showed me more avenues for doing it. And it continues to back up that, yes, I always seem to have the right direction for these people, the outside eyes that they need. I just had this experience yesterday. Someone was saying, hey, I'm trying to do this consulting and here's what I offer people. And I said to them, this is Cub, you know, confusing, unbelievable, and boring, which is, you know, something we use in our copy reviews.
Yeah.
Something is confusing, unbelievable, and boring. We shorten it to Cub. And I said, your description of what you're offering here is confusing, unbelievable, and boring. I can't understand what you're trying to say. And I know you, so I don't see how this would go and attract any clients. So then I rewrote it for them and it was very clear. And they're like, oh my goodness, your outside eyes were so strong here. Thank you. And it's just a matter of that happens over and over and over again. And it's also a matter of me working so hard on myself that I figure out what works, what doesn't, to make long-term habit changes, to make them faster. And when you do that over and over again, and you believe that you can do it and you help a lot of other people do it. And then there's something that is an intangible that's hard to describe, but I definitely know most other people don't have it. That's why I say that I have the gift for it.
Yeah. Well, and that was, just a, you know, following up on that, I think, you know, if I were a business owner who didn't know you from Adam and I wanted a business coach and I came to you and I said, Craig Ballantyne, why should I hire you as my business coach instead of, you know, Frank over there? What is the differentiating factor for Craig Ballantyne? You talked about a little bit already, but if you were to give him a quick 50-cent pitch, like, how would you differentiate yourself from other business coaches?
Oh, I would say that we move faster and we go deeper than most other business coaches. And there's absolutely no fluff. It's straight to the point. If you're the type of person who doesn't respond well to the blunt directions, who really needs to be coddled and needs, you know, the softer side of things, there's other coaches out there who can do that. And that's neither right nor wrong. You know, you're going to go and gravitate towards the approach. But if someone just, you know, wants to show up, you know, and say, I'm ready for my marching orders, and they want the right marching orders for them, I'm going to deliver those, and I'm going to hold you accountable to them, and then you're going to come back. That's a really good fit for me in my coaching, and I'm going to be a really good fit for the type of person who looks for that, who's just like, I don't want any fluff. I want to get right to it. I want to get the results as fast as possible, and you don't have to baby me. Then, hey, you're my guy.
Is there anything to, in my mind, when you're building that relationship, they have to trust you as a business coach. So you're on the same page as far as communication is concerned, as you just described. But sort of how do you build that trust and relatability with a new client?
I think it's a lot of what you've kind of asked about as we've gone through this. Hey, you've mentioned this. Hey, you've talked about this struggle. And when you do that, you show the person, hey, listen, doesn't matter what you're going through right now, I've been in the same position or worse. You know, I have been struggling here. I have struggled with this in my life. I've struggled with something else in my life. These are all the personal stories I have to bring to this. And when you do that, whether you're a personal trainer, whether you're a business coach, people want something to connect with you there. And I get a lot of people who come in and say, oh, you know, I grew up on a farm, or, you know, my father had struggles, or, you know, this, that, or the other thing. And so the more that you share as a coach, as an entrepreneur, the more connected people are going to get to you, because they're going to latch on to those things. And that's why I do so many of these podcasts. That's why I don't care about what anybody asks me. People always say, are there any questions off limits? I say, absolutely not, because I'll answer anything, because I don't have anything to hide. And I was talking to a coach the other day, and I had read their bio, and I said, well, this is really great what you did, you know, 10 years ago and what you're doing now, but I don't understand how you got from there to there. And they go, yeah, you know, I don't talk about that period in my life. And as soon as they said that to me, I got very disinterested in them, because I just felt like their entire story had unraveled in front of my face. And it's like, well, now what do I take? You're only showing
right.
The world the ups and not the downs, when the entrepreneurial roller coaster is full of a whole lot of downs as well as the ups. And I'm going to prove to you that I've been through them. I'm going to go through them. and I'm the best person to get you through them.
Yeah, that transparency is part of the key to building the trust, obviously. I'm wondering in those coaching client relationships, to what extent you have to worry about drawing a line in the sand between divulging personal and professional information and the overlap there, if you're even concerned about that, if you understand that as part of work-life mastery, there's going to be a balance there that you have to deal with as a coach, or do you specifically say, no, I'm not going to deal with the personal elements. I just want to coach you as a business coach.
I think almost everything that I do as a business coach is all the personal stuff. It's always the personal habits. It's the personal obstacles. It's the personal resistance. It's the personal life stuff that gets in the way of most people becoming a very successful entrepreneur and being in their professional lives. And so we are always dealing with that. And that's this type of stuff that we have to work on first, whether it is personality or mental obstacles, or whether it's, you know, mom's in a nursing home and, you know, that's consuming 80% of my time. That's the stuff that we deal with the most. And so I never shy away from any of it.
Do you find that other coaches do?
I can't say in a broad generalization, but I know that Bedros Koulian, he probably is in the exact same boat. And because he has hundreds and hundreds of fitness franchise owners and personal trainers that get coaching from him. And we share some of the same clients. So I hear quite a few of the same things that they would tell him. And I know they're going very deep in personal stuff. And he's brought his own therapist that he has gone to coaching sessions and masterminds. So I think he would agree that we deal more with the personal stuff. I don't know for sure about a lot of other business coaches, but the ones that I know definitely deal with it.
It would be hard to draw a line in the sand, absolutely, because they do overlap. Your personal qualities obviously affect how you're conducting your business. So let's sort of set the scene. So in 2011, you had a conversation with your business partner, Matt Smith, about sort of next steps, what you really, really wanted. And what ended up happening was you took over Early to Rise from Mark Ford.
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering, 2011, 2018, has the mission of ETR changed at all from what Mark Ford created to obviously what it is today?
I don't think so. I think it's still committed to high-performing individuals who want to be successful in every area of life. This is not just about digital marketing. It is not just about investing. It's not just about real estate. It's not about getting rich at the expense of everything. I think my recent interview with Mark goes to show that Early to Rise is on the right path, because he talks about how some of the things that he would have changed had he done it maybe more the Early to Rise way instead of the hardcore wealth building that he did. And so I think definitely the philosophy of Early to Rise has not changed. It's, Mark and I are two different people, and he has a wealth of knowledge that is vastly greater than mine in the wealth building aspect. So I think the delivery of some of the content hasn't been up to the same level that Mark has had in the past, but we've always been working on improving that. I think we're getting back to the best spot we can.
Yeah. Well, and the audience changes over time, and you bring more people in who have different needs and concerns. So it's bound to change to some respect. You have said that you want to catalyze the change of 10 million people. That's a big number. Why 10 million?
Well, it started off as 1 million. So when I hired Yannick Silver and I joined his mastermind group, he said, Craig, you got to have this 1 million transformation mission in your business. And so I did that. And I think we can easily say that we've accomplished it, because we've had hundreds of thousands of people buy Turbulence Training and our other programs. We've had, some of our YouTube videos have been watched over 2 million times alone. I think we have a collective view of 7 or 8 million views now. Now, I'm sure there's multiple repeat viewers, and some of those people didn't do anything with it. But I think we're well on our way to 10 million. It's impossible for me to catalog it, but I think we're almost at the 10 million, and I think we have to raise that again. So we're very fortunate to live in this day and age where you can reach a very large audience even without traditional television or speaking tours or whatever. So we are able to do that, and I think we're going to continue to do it, and we're just getting started. So we've got millions to go.
And it's going to scale and grow exponentially, hopefully. But I'm wondering, when you say catalyze change in 10 million people, what does success look like?
That's a great question. And so what does success look like? Success really looks like, is somebody in a better spot now than they were before taking a look at our information? And you know, do you catalog that as 5 pounds lost or, you know, an extra $100,000? It's really a subjective and objective thing at the same time. But I'm just thinking, have we had an impact on somebody when we've changed their way life in a positive way where they would come and say, like, hey, I've read the book, Perfect Day Formula, made me more productive. It's totally changed my life. Well, I mean, do I have to dig deep into their finances? Do I have to dig deep into their body composition to say that we've helped them? I don't think so. It's really just, have we made an impact on somebody? And so it is a little bit broad, but that's the impact that, and that's what success looks like in terms of a transformation for somebody.
Right, right. And the more engagement we get, the more we know, of course,
sure,
that success is happening. So I wanna do a deep dive back to 2011. You've written a lot of content for Early to Rise, obviously. And a lot of the successful content that really resonates with people is content that brings up your own personal example and personal life stories. Mm-hmm. Sometimes failure, sometimes successes. One of the things you wrote back in 2011 was called 12 Rules I Live By.
Mm-hmm.
So the big question, I'm going to go through a couple of these because I think they're particularly interesting, but I'm wondering, do you remember that full list?
I don't have it memorized, but I...
Yeah. Do you feel like you're still living by those same 12 rules?
Yeah. I think absolutely. I think like if of all the articles on Early to Rise, I'd probably have to edit that one the least. I don't think anything has changed in there. I think I've only gotten stronger on some of them. Some of them at the time were written aspirationally, and I've just gotten better at them. And so I would probably maybe cut back on some of them. I think they don't need to be rules for my life, but you know, I'd probably get it down to like 8 or 10. But I absolutely positively believe in all of those things. I live by all those things, and you know, in 40 years, it'll be the same thing.
You have been called the most disciplined man in the world, the most productive man in the world. But number 11 on this list really strikes me. It's a quote from Ted Nicholas that says, "I will always keep the child within me alive." How do you do that?
I goof around a lot. Most people just don't see it. And so,
okay.
You know, like Bedros would say, there's a Craig that most people don't see. I like to hang around kids more than I like to hang around adults, mostly because kids are just fun and not jaded and cynical like many adults are.
That's true.
So that's what I do in terms of it. I Toys for Tots is another chance for us to do that.
Right.
And maybe I don't play enough games as I would like to, but I just don't have the people to do that with. And so, but it's always about laughing and joking and, you know, hanging around this guy, Jason Ferrugia. He would also say that there's a Craig that most people don't see. It's just, it really is something I believe in and still try and do as much as possible.
Well, I hope we see more of it.
Yeah.
Maybe for Instagram or something. Are you still a non-swearer? That's still part of your...
I do very well at it. I'm tempted once in a while to like throw more swearing into the Instagram stories and stuff to make the impact. But I always think back to, okay, you got Martin Luther King. It's Martin Luther King Jr., right? I'm Canadian, so I'm okay with getting the names wrong. And JFK, you know, those are like two of the greatest speeches speakers that ever lived, at least in modern times. And those guys did not swear. So if those guys can have an impact on the world, well, they did not swear in their speeches. So why do I need to swear in my presentations, in my speeches, to have an impact, to get a laugh? If I can't get a laugh without swearing, then I'm not working hard enough. And so I really respect a guy like Brian Regan, who is a comic who does not swear. And he's really funny. And yes, a well-timed F-bomb is really funny and can have a great impact. But you know, I like the personal challenge of it as well. And so, yeah, I stick to it as much as possible. Very, very, you know, 99% of the time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, kudos to you for doing it. And it is a good challenge to force you to rethink how you articulate things so you're not swearing. I'm wondering, number 3 on this list, I really question, I do not check email before 11 a.m.
Oh, yeah. So that has changed. That one, I guess, has changed. Now, when I wrote that one, I was at the point that I was checking email every other day. I wasn't even checking email every day. But then now I'm more of in a manager position in our business, and also just in terms of the time difference between where I am when I'm on the East Coast and or I'm on West Coast and it's all over the place. And my coaching clients are all around the world. Now I still do get one major thing done. I still do write my 1,000 or 1,500 words before I check email. And then I'm up pretty early in the morning. And the other thing is I don't actually get that much email. So I've tamed the email beast so that now it's not really something that interferes with my productivity. So
yeah,
that one I probably could rewrite in some way or just drop, because it served me to a point when I needed it to fight off email, which was a bad habit and really got in the way of me being successful. And also, since we got out of the fitness space, I no longer really get negative emails. Like, you know, people don't email you and say, hey, I hate this program or anything. So I don't, you know, and we were dealing in much larger volumes of customers compared to when you're doing high-end coaching.
Sure.
So going into my email inbox was always something I dreaded back then, because you never knew who found your email and would just send you like some really nasty emails because they disagreed with your philosophy on exercise. I mean, some people are so irrational about things. And that's why back then in 2011, I had this rule of staying out of my email for as long as possible. And again, was even up to the point where I only checked it every other day for a while, for about a 6-month period, just Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So that one could probably be one of the ones that get cut.
Yeah. That's an interesting point, though, because for those people who do have to deal with customer service, you're going to inevitably deal with negative comments, complaints from customers, and that can ruin the day.
Absolutely.
How do you bounce back from that? How do you let that not affect you?
Oh, it is very difficult, and I don't know if anybody can say that it doesn't affect them. So you just have to, you might have to have a routine. I remember one time I got a nasty email from somebody back in 2009-ish. No, maybe 2007-ish. And I went outside and I walked around the block and I realized no one's throwing stones at me in the real world. So everything's okay. So I think it's a matter of perspective. Maybe you need to go and read some testimonials from people to be reminded of what you're doing. Maybe you need to call somebody and just vent. Maybe you need to, take your dog for a walk. But you just need to reframe your mind. And it's the same goes with anything. You know, if you get thrown off track with your time management, you get thrown off track with an argument with a friend, a relative, somebody that works with you, you have to have these anchors that get you back. Maybe it's listening to a Tony Robbins speech. Maybe it's listening to your favorite song. But a high performer does not allow themselves to be thrown off track for very long. And they get back on track as quickly as possible.
Well, it's good to have those built-in systems so you can balance out some negativity. I'm going to transition again to the morning routine product and the morning routine concept that you've built up here at Early to Rise. You famously say, keep it simple. Don't do 18 different things in the morning because it's just going to ruin your productivity and focus. So I'm wondering, and that doesn't necessarily have to stay the same, of course. So I'm wondering, over the years, how you've gone about figuring out what your number one thing is and what it is today and how you're executing on it.
Well, my number one thing is always going to be writing. I think it's always going to be writing. It often has been writing. And so I prepare the night before to make sure that I have a good block of time to go and write whatever needs to be written, whether it's for our website, whether it's for a book, whether it's for video scripts. Writing at that time of day that's when it's easiest for me, because that's what I'm always going to do first thing in the morning. Doing these podcasts is really easy later on in the day, but not early in the morning. So that's why I want to have my focus first thing. And it might vary over time as to what I'm writing about, but I'm always going to do that work early. And now somebody else listening, well, they might be thinking, well, what's my most important thing that I can focus on early in the morning to do the first things first? And it's just a matter of self-reflection into your life, into what will move you ahead fastest in whatever area that you're trying to improve. And then understand what's most important to you. And then by doing that self-reflection, that's a kind of an overview of it compared to what we have in the course and in our workshops. But it is pretty simple. Like, you just need to know what's important to you and what you should be focusing on. Often what's a hard thing that you want to avoid, that's often the first thing you should do. It's much like when I was training people, and whenever someone said, I hate this exercise, you knew that that was one of the most important exercises for them to do on a regular basis.
Because it's where they're weakest, so that's where they need to build up the most.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be the biggest struggle for them, biggest challenge.
Right. You also, of course, have written a lot about habit change, and that kind of goes hand in hand with morning routine to some extent, and certainly with productivity. And I'm wondering how the digital revolution has changed how you look at the sort of instructional content around habit change in 2018. So has it changed at all? Like when you started in 2001 and you were to tell someone this is how you change your habits versus 2018, what would the different like instruction around that look like, given the fact that we're now attached to our devices and sort of consume the world differently?
So I think that the biggest thing is that most people are not going to be doing the first stage, which is the planning and preparation and the self-reflection. Because they are tied to their devices, they don't feel like they have a free minute. They can't step away from electronics and they never get clear thinking. But if you don't do that, then you're never going to make the changes because that's the first step. So you have to put the phones away. You have to put all the email away and then go and sit there and think, okay, what am I doing right? What am I doing wrong? What's the plan to make the change? And that is the first pillar in my five pillars of transformation and five pillars of success. And if you don't do that one, you can't go on and go through the rest of them in order to be successful. So you have to take time away. So I think the biggest problem is that people think they're busier than ever now, self-imposed busyness. And that's why they feel like they can't make the change, is because they're overwhelmed with all the, you know, dopamine hits that social media is providing them. And they're kind of chained and handcuffed more than ever before.
Yeah, it's information overload. That's the era that we're in right now, absolutely. Getting it from all sides. So, you know, I'm wondering, and this ties into what the kind of content that we're going to be producing in the next year or so. ETR is growing, which is obviously very good, and we're building out the content. What are the major pain points that you think we're going to have to address in 2018, 2019 for our audience?
For our readers?
Yeah.
I think that we're going to help them continue to make the separation between work and home life, to show them how to do it, to show them how to separate themselves for their phones so that they can go back to the work that matters. And it's classic, you know, Stephen Covey, four quadrants where there was urgent and important and non-urgent but important. We need to shift our readers back into the non-urgent but important work. And that's, you know, writing your book, that's creating the marketing plans, and versus the urgent but important, which is email and social media and all the notifications and stuff. And we're going to continue to work and work and work and show our readers easy systems for them, hacks, if you want to call it, that allow them to make the right decisions more automatically and get into that deep work flow that Cal Newport talks about, because that's where they're going to make the biggest leaps ahead. And so it's just showing people, don't get sucked into the superficial, don't get sucked into the icing on the cake, get back to the cake, the real stuff that matters, so that you can make the biggest leaps ahead, whether it's in your family or whether it's in your business or your career or your personal life or in fighting stress. You really need to do that deep, focused work.
You know, I'm wondering for the readers that you've communicated with, and with some of your clients, what is some of the biggest resistance you've faced to your coaching efforts beyond laziness, which is kind of a given? What resistance are they giving you, or arguments against some of your tactics and philosophies?
I would say there's some self-belief issues, and we work through that through a series of exercises. They don't think they can do it. It hasn't worked in the past. You know, why is this going to be different this time? But then we show them a few things, and it does. A lot of people are also resistant to changing anything in the routine. So we had one couple who do a coaching program of their own, and they were working in the business first thing in the morning. They were responding to clients. But they knew that had to be done any time of the day. And then they were pushing off the non-urgent but important stuff. And they were saying, okay, I'm going to do the urgent but important stuff and work in the business first thing in the morning, and I'll do that other stuff later. But then something always would come up. And when I finally convinced them to change, where they worked on the business, on the non-urgent but important projects that move them ahead, that help them develop new products and new programs and apps and all these things that would serve their customers, then they still managed to get the work in the business of emails back to their clients done before the end of the day, and they became, you know, multiple factors more productive. And so it's just a matter of everybody's got the routines and rituals and the ways of doing things, but just because you did something that way in the past is not the most important thing. So I'm always coaching them. What got you here won't get you there. What got you here won't get you there. And you have to be open to the new stuff. And they are open. Otherwise, they wouldn't be working with me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you see those success stories. As they develop and grow and work on their own struggles and challenges, what are you working on personally?
Working on a new anxiety book. So that one is done, but I went to a publisher and I think we need an edge to it, whether it's an entrepreneur edge or some other angle for it to make it a really, really great book. So that's kind of like one of my biggest challenges right now, to figure that out, and then to grow our coaching program. So it's not just relying on in-person workshops, but to take the program and deliver it digitally around the world so that we can have probably 10 times as many people going through it. So it's just, it's all very good problems that we have right now. And it's just taking something that has proven to work so very well and making it accessible to so many more people.
Yeah. Yeah. And I look forward to seeing that digital representation of what we have so far. That's going to be really cool. I'm just going to close it out on a light note here. I have seen some of this in your Instagram stories, but what do you do to unwind besides going to the gym? I mean, I see you a lot at the gym, but I also see you at restaurants a lot. Are you a big foodie at all? Or?
I wouldn't call myself a foodie. I'd probably eat cardboard if I could just eat a lot of it. So I'm not really particular on fancy restaurants. I just like hanging out with smart people, good conversation. So Bedros and I do a lot of traveling together and we have a lot of good meals. And we always try to invite somebody who's going to entertain us, because Bedros and I actually are both relatively introverted and we don't actually talk that much when we eat. So we always try and bring some like total extrovert, total storyteller, and we'll just sit there for hours and let them do the talking. So I enjoy that. And then, like you said, it's exercise, it's walking the dog. And I just like to read. I would just be very happy to be in a room reading books, not related to business, and just reading a lot of the time. So I'm very simple. What's that?
What are you reading right now?
One of the books I'm reading right now is The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. It's the annotated version. It's only 1,200 pages, but it's really a fascinating book. So my friend Simon Black is a major history buff. The guy knows so much about history and he brings it into a lot of his articles, and he always talks about this one. So I'm reading that one. I'm reading the autobiography of a yogi, which is very bizarre. Definitely kind of hard to believe in some cases. And then another book that I'm reading right now is Sapiens, which has been recommended to me by a lot of people. It's a real quick history of how we came to be. So those ones, and you know what, really bizarre is I read the first couple pages of the Book of Mormon in the hotel yesterday, because I actually have a couple of friends who are Mormon, and I'm like, you know what? I may as well just kind of get the handle on this so that I don't ask them really stupid questions. So I've read a little bit about that, but I think maybe I'll just fast track it and go to the musical.
Which I still haven't seen. I want to see it. I heard it's a good one. Anyway, that's it for me, Craig. Thanks so much for taking the time today. I'll turn the mic back over to you next week, of course, but it was a lot of fun to do the reverse interview.
Well, thank you, Jeff. I really appreciate those questions. I think everyone's going to love the stories that we told. And hey, listen, if anybody thinks that we still haven't gone deep enough into one aspect of it, or you think that there's more stories that you want to hear about my dad or my mom or my sister, or, you know, me growing up, you know, just let them rip. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll make sure there's teaching points in there, obviously, so that you guys get the most out of it. So we really appreciate you listening, and really appreciate the hard hitting 60-minute style investigative reporting from Jeff Steen here at Early to Rise. So thanks so much. Well, there you go. I held nothing back. So what did you think? Jeff and I would love to hear your opinion about today's show and how you plan to use my life's lessons to inspire you to success. So keep me posted and email me at support@earlytorise.com, or send me a message on instagram.com/realcraigballantyne or at twitter.com/craigballantyne. Thanks again for listening to Early to Rise Radio. Head over to iTunes and rate today's show and share it with your friends. And please don't forget to pick up a copy of my book with even more tales about how Craig Ballantyne became the world's most productive man. You can get your free copy at freeperfectdaybook.com.